In the northeast quadrant of the United States is an area called Northwoods. In a moment, Paul Bartholomew, the other half is Robert Bartholomew. Paul is joining us with their work, The Mysterious Northwoods. We're going to talk about strange anomalies that have been happening out that way. Wait till you hear these stories. And welcome back to Coast. We're back with Paul Bartholomew, back with us after almost 4.5 years. He's been researching cryptozoology, UFOs, paranormal phenomena for 4 decades, earning a BS in communications from Castleton University in Vermont. Bartholomew also studied under anthropologist Professor Warren L. Cook, and together they investigated many sightings of large, unknown, hairy, bipedal creatures sighted throughout the Northeast. In 2004, Paul wrote and lobbied for legislation to create a protective habitat for Bigfoot or Sasquatch in his hometown of Whitehall, New York. His book with his brother Robert is called The Mysterious Northwoods. He's also written a book called Bigfoot Encounters in New York and New England. Paul, welcome back, my friend. How have you been?
Excellent. Great to talk to you again, George, and appreciate coming on here.
I'm looking forward to this. And by the way, thank you. You sent me, included in the book, a picture of you and Lorraine, the late Lorraine Warren, which really struck my heart. I mean, what a wonderful person she was.
She really was. And, you know, we were in contact with her for many years there. And of course, now the claim of the Conjuring films and so forth really put her in the Hollywood frame of mind, but Lorraine really did a lot of the early research, her and Ed, and really paved the way for what ghost hunters and researchers do today. And we were in contact with her since the 70s or so, and she was always just a really sweet person, and really miss her.
What was it about the UFOs, the paranormal, and cryptozoology that captured your attention?
Well, you know, I grew up, I would have been 9 years old in 1973, and there was a major UFO flap that occurred in October of 73 that kept going for actually several years. But, I mean, there was a concentration of sightings in October of 73, and you remember the famous cases back then. We had Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Yep.
Charles Hickson and
Calvin
Parker.
Classics. I think the Lonnie Zamora case was right around then, too.
Yeah, Lonnie was back in the 60s. But this one here was in 73, and it was October 18th, and these two gentlemen were out fishing, you know, shipyard workers, and
mm-hmm.
and they claimed to have been floated aboard a craft. And it became a really interesting case and got national attention, but it was really just sort of the spark of this huge flap of sightings that were going to take place, and they were highly credible. And these folks were given polygraphs, they passed. The police officials had actually hit a tape recorder in the room to listen to what they were talking about when they left the room, and they were just about climbing the walls because they were so traumatized by
right.
this experience. So that's a very credible case. You know, Charles Hickson went on to talk about it fairly openly, and then Calvin Parker just nowadays is really reliving his experience and talking about what had happened to him. And these were largely negative experiences that had happened to these people. These weren't positive, happy experiences. These were life-changing and negative to a large degree. But what we found out with a case like Charles Hickson was that he had claimed he was being followed by unusual objects, UFOs. And so Ray Stanford actually invited him down to his Project Starlight International in Texas. And they were able to track a UFO upon his arrival there, which they had only done, I think, 9 times at that point. So it seemed to confirm his allegation that there was much more going on here. And I think Calvin Parker has recently spoken in the same way. I know Calvin confirmed that Ray Stanford had told him that story as well. So we also look a week after this classic astounding national attention sighting, we had the coin helicopter case, which occurred in Mansfield, Ohio. And that was where this Army Reserve chopper was flying. Larry Coyne was the leader of it. There was a 4-man crew, and they encountered an object that they thought was going to collide with their helicopter.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, the object stops on a dime and engulfs their helicopter in light. And they did this tremendous maneuver where he went from an elevation of 1,700 feet to about 3,500 feet in seconds.
Oh, wow.
And he had no idea how they had done this because he was worried that they were going to crash. And so this has never adequately been explained. However, it was so credible that Coyne was actually one of the witnesses that testified before the UN when they had a meeting on this topic. So these are really highly credible, interesting cases. And in 1973, you know, I'm this kid. I'm watching the news. I'm seeing this. It starts to become a constant report in the news media. And I started looking into different cases, and it turns out that this area as well had been rocked in October and on through into December by UFO sightings. In October as well, in Rochester, New York, there were V-shaped objects reported by at least a dozen witnesses to an astronomer at the planetarium at Rochester Museum and Science Center. And he said, the astronomer was named Terry Dickinson, and he said something unusual was up there, and it drew people's attention. I'm rather intrigued by it. So, I mean, there's another very credible case, something that shouldn't have been there that was reported. And, you know, prior to this incident in August in Schenectady, New York, two men had encountered a UFO that was flying over the area. And they said that they used to have VHF monitors, you know, scanners that they would monitor. And they said that their scanners were on the fritz. A huge static was associated with the objects. And once the objects left, the scanners returned to normal. So this is another effect, whether it's an electromagnetic effect, we don't know, but it's another effect that verifies that something unusual was going on. Now, in November, you know, a month after the Pascagoula incident and in the Coyne case, we had a football-shaped luminous object that was seen by at least four witnesses, including a Hartford policeman named Stephen Brogel. And he said he observed this object dart back and forth across the sky for about 10 minutes.
Wow.
He says, it was weird. The strangest thing I've ever saw, he says, honest to God. And he said that his police radio, much like the scanner reports from a couple of months earlier, his police radio was filled with static, and he was unable to use it while he was actually watching these objects with other witnesses. So here we go, a police encounter, credible cases, one after the other after the other. And then we look into also in November down in Freeport, Long Island. They had possible landing rings that were found and so forth. But there was a massive UFO experience between three police officers. Again, we add that credibility factor of police officers seeing this unexplained phenomena. And they were able to chase a UFO as it darted across the sky and actually merged with a smaller craft. And then they were able to plot where these locations were that the sightings were made, and they determined that the object was traveling at between 7,000 and 8,000 miles per hour. And, of course, stopping on a dime, merging together, all these really high strangeness effects, which can't be explained by the normal air traffic or machinery at the time. So as this goes on, and you know, I'm just becoming completely engrossed with this topic. We had a landing case up here in my neck of the woods. It was up in Glen Lake. I live in Whitehall, which is
You're still out that way, right?
I am. I've always lived in Whitehall, New York, which used to be called Skeensboro. And so this landing case was about a half an hour from where I live. And it was at a restaurant there that's no longer there. It's called the La Cabana Restaurant. The structure is there, but it's no longer a restaurant. He had a dirt parking lot. And this is in one of those back roads type of areas. It's on the lake, but it's in a woodsy area and a narrow roads and so forth, a very country look to it. And Jack Bergeron was the owner back then, and he returned. They had been closed the night before. He returned on December 13th, and he found these two concentric circles that were in the dirt parking lot of his restaurant. And there's a famous photo of him pointing to the circles. And he said that he needed to get a shovel so that he could get inside the door because so much dirt was thrown against the door. And this is a bizarre place for anything to land. That's what made this so incredibly weird. You know, you just couldn't bring a helicopter in and land, and it just didn't make any sense. There's trees there and so forth. But something had definitely landed. And residents had claimed that they heard mechanical-type noises in the woods that weren't weather-related. There was no weather phenomena to report this, no strange winds. This was during a continual UFO flap of that time. In fact, the night before, someone had claimed that they had taken a picture of an object, but I've never been able to locate that picture, but definitely another sighting.
Were there any burn marks, Paul, or pads or anything, pods landing or anything like that?
Well, the circles themselves were right into the dirt, and the dirt looked like it had been altered in a way, but not necessarily burned. But it appeared different than the dirt surrounding it.
Okay.
But there was another effect that even drew out much more interest. Is they found out that the hot water taps inside the restaurant ran cold, and the cold water taps ran hot.
That's weird.
And this was for a couple of weeks following the encounter, and then it returned back to normal. And they've never been able to adequately explain that. In fact, if anybody has any information on a similar type of landing case where that effect has specifically been noted, I'd be really interested in hearing from them because I think this might be unique to this.
I've never heard of that one before. That is unique.
That's right. This was would have been normally termed a classic CE2 or close encounter of the second kind, where Dr. Hynek would say, you know, the UFO leaves its calling card. It's something to look at, something to investigate. And at the time, there were a couple of civilian groups. I think it was the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, mm-hmm. NICAP.
NICAP, yeah.
And I think APRO may have been involved, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. But I don't know what the final conclusions that they had were. I think at the time it was just all very anomalous, and we never adequately explained what happened. But the fact is, something landed there, and it caused an effect that you couldn't hoax. You know, no one would be able to hoax the hot water taps and the cold water taps changing. So it's really indicative that perhaps there was a large electromagnetic field that caused this effect. But, you know, I'm wide open as to trying to explain it. But this is that era of the 1970s, and it seemed to really spark in 1973. Just great cases, one after the other.
We've got some of those concentric circles up on the coasttocoastam.com website, Paul. And we don't seem to be getting those kinds of cases today. We had landing marks. We had all those kinds of cases, but we don't get them today. Why do you think that?
That is a fascinating observation, and it's one that has puzzled me for years. It seemed like those were hand in hand, and we even got them when Bud Hopkins was in the prime of his research in the 80s. We would get those types of cases. They seem to be much, much more rare now. Back then in the 70s, we had another ring case connected to the Bigfoot outbreak that we had back in 1976. And we had also connections to Kinderhook, New York, where Bruce Hallenbeck is a researcher. He had found a ring down there that was very similar to these landing cases that occur. And, you know, it's very interesting. I don't know what the ultimate explanation is, but it seems like that 70s was almost a magical time in the research of this type of case.
Tell us a little bit about the mysterious North Woods. What's been going on out there?
Well, what we did is we took a look at the Adirondacks in the of New York and the Green Mountains of Vermont, and we sort of used those as a microcosm of what's going on in the entire Northeast. And what we found is that probably you could take almost any area, and if you put it under enough of a microscope, you will find a history of paranormal phenomena. These are common human experiences that have been reported long, long ago, right up to modern times. We can go back to the days of the Algonquin and the Iroquois and legends of stone giants and giant men of the mountains, and you would have reports of these Bigfoot-type creatures. Of course, if you did a search engine on a newspaper, let's say in the 1800s, you wouldn't punch in Bigfoot. You would punch in something like strange bear, creature. You would punch in the big word would be wild man. And then you would get scores of reports. So it shows that this Bigfoot phenomena, the Sasquatch phenomena in the Northeast, was incredibly consistent, going all the way back to the legends of stone giants and giant men of the mountains and Wendigos, right up to, well, I've got a report. We've got breaking news we'll cover. We had a report of a Bigfoot-type creature just a few days ago.
Wow.
In the Bennington area.
Fantastic.
So this is an incredibly consistent phenomena that is a little different from, let's say, the Chupacabra reports, you know, the goat sucker reports. Those were primarily down in Texas and Puerto Rico and, you know, maybe some in Florida and so forth. And they primarily started in the mid-90s, although you may be able to reach back to the 70s and find a case here or there that could be considered that. But the primary mass sightings of these creatures occurred about the mid-90s. The Bigfoot phenomena is much different. It can be traced back centuries.
Is it unusual, Paul, that you have so many Bigfoot cases and UFO cases? Is there a connection here?
Yeah, this is what really started the wheels going here. In 1976, we had what would have been termed initially a Bigfoot outbreak on a road, a rural road in Whitehall called Abear Road. And that became a huge case in the Northeast, a landmark case everybody seems to remember. Several police officers had encountered a creature. In a nutshell, if we boil it all down, we get three teenagers encounter a creature out on Abear Road. Initially, it was two. They went and got a third, and they all saw this creature. They speed away, leaving tread marks in the road from where they were going. And back then, it was a different time period. We always had a officer on duty at the police station. And he would handle the calls. Now it's handled through county. But it was a great job to have a dispatcher. He would be there all night, maybe watch a little TV, maybe handle a couple of calls. Terrific job. And back then it was Bob Martell was our police dispatcher. And I talked with Bob. And he said, yeah, they reported it. And the Whitehall police, the Washington County Deputy Sheriff, and the Whitehall police, the New York State troopers all responded to the scene. So over this week-long period in August of 1976, we had reports of Bigfoot-type creatures. In fact, we may have had as many as a dozen or more separate reports because the case is still going. We're still getting reports. When Seth Breedlove came up and did a documentary on Abear Road, he turned up more witnesses.
Fantastic. Paul, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about what the heck is going on up that way in the northeast portion of the United States. And then we'll take calls next hour here on Coast to Coast. The name of the latest book that Paul wrote with his brother Robert, The Mysterious North Woods. Very strange little things are happening out that way. But we'll be back in a moment. Don't touch your dial right here on Coast to Coast AM. We will be right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Paul Bartholomew with us. We'll take calls with Paul next hour here on Coast to Coast. Paul, what does your gut tell you about Bigfoot? I mean, you've investigated this for years. I'm sure you've come up with some of your own conclusions. What does it feel like?
Well, you know, it's one of those things. As a researcher, I'm just objectively collecting the data as accurately as possible. But what happens is you get common denominators, common reports happen time and time again, and it really makes you wonder if there isn't a larger perspective going on here, something that's much larger scale than just an unknown creature. For instance, with this report that we had on Abear in 76, Abear Road, we had so many witnesses in a credible sighting. But what was often overlooked is that this was during a major UFO flap at exactly the same time. that engulfed the entire Northeast. And it was actually some of the more sensitive reports went down to the nuclear power stations down in, towards New York City. So we were on alert pretty much from what was going on in August of 1976. So now we add to that a report that we had of a pterodon-type creature, a thunderbird, if you will, which said that the creature looked like it had, it was like liquid reality was the description, and this was by a couple of hunters. But it was only one report, but we add that to the mix, and we have what is thought to be a Bigfoot-type encounter now is more or less a paranormal outbreak that occurred in August of 76 in the Whitehall area. So we've got all these phenomena occurring as once. And what Dr. Hynek thought, he thought that, you know, we're getting on to, with the UFO research, we're talking about maybe parallel realities was a term that he used. And what Jack Vallee talks about, you know, that there's much more to this, that what's going on. So I looked at the research of people like John Keel, you know, from the Mothman Prophecy.
Right, exactly.
He had written, and Brad Steiger. And they had talked about different manifestations from the same source phenomena. And it does appear that there may be something to that theory. Now, it sounds kind of out there, except if you relate it to a common concept. For instance, you know, endlessness is just one of those things we can't really comprehend unless you apply a concept like a number line to it, and then you can go infinitely in any direction or in between. So if we apply something to this different manifestations from the same source phenomena, let's just take water, for example. If we have water and we report what water looks like, it might be a raging brook, it might be a tranquil pond, it's got a liquid appearance to it, you know, it may reflect all these different reports that we have of water. But if you take that same water, that same H2O, and you freeze it, now we have something that's not amorphic, but it's finite in its definition. If I were to take regular water and throw it against my face, I would cleanse myself, I could drink it and nourish myself. But now in ice form, if I throw it against my face, I cause damage. It's a completely different report. I can't ingest it as that. So now we crank up the temperature, you know, some, and now that ice melts, becomes water again, and then it becomes vapor or mist. And now we have that same source phenomena of water, and yet it's now a mist, and it's affecting me in a different way. I can't see. It's affecting my vision. I may have different densities that I'm trying to look through. It might be affecting my breathing. So if we just apply what's going on with the paranormal to water, we would have different manifestations from that same source phenomena.
It's amazing that people are just, you know, trying to figure out what these things are. What about dimensional? Does that come up?
Yeah, I think that all plays into this, that we may be talking about, you know, Michio Kaku talks about other dimensions, and I think that's what Dr. Hynek was leaning towards the end of his life, and that, you know, that I think is very plausible. And when we get into quantum physics and dark matter, I mean, the possibilities here really become opened up, and the science fiction of the past becomes our future science.
Indeed. Since you've been investigating this all these years, what has been one of the strangest things you've come across?
Well, what we get, we get 14 reports. You know, Charles Fort was the obviously had ties to my neck of the woods here. He was born down in Albany, Albany, New York, in the 1800s, and he died in the Bronx. So he was a through and through New Yorker, and he wrote about what he called or what was dubbed a Fortean phenomena. And he had kind of an interesting take on it. He would write about it, and he sort of was skeptical, but also a satirist. And he wrote four main books, which were, you know, The Book of the Damned, and that's basically reports that don't coincide with what modern science can explain. And he also wrote New Lands and Low and New Talents, and they all sort of incorporate strange phenomena. And the story was that he would collect these reports and put them in shoeboxes, and then he would write books. And so he became sort of, these are some of the stranger reports. We had a report from Granville in which a snake fell from the sky. And the guy picks it up, and it appeared to live for a little while. And yet, you know, it seems like a bizarre experience, something that couldn't possibly happen. And yet we have reports of fish falling from the sky.
And frogs? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that was, you know, so these became known as Fortean phenomena. And, you know, there's the International Fortean Organization, and they used to have conferences and things. And so, yeah, these types of reports sort of fly in the face of science, and they're almost begging to be explained.
Paul, since you've been investigating, of course, and again, you've been at this for a long time, but what about real old cases? Wasn't there something back in the 1800s out that way, too?
Oh, yeah. The consistency of the Bigfoot phenomenon can be traced way back. I mean, thousands of years in Chinese records where it's the Che Ren or the Wild Man. But, you know, we had reports from the 1800s in the New York Times. And of course, the key there is to look up, is to put in that word search, Wild Man, and you'll get tons of reports. So the ancient reports are very interesting. We get some, you know, from the 1930s. We had a report from the 1930s from, guess where? Amityville, Long Island.
There you go.
And it said, you know, strange creature down there, and it actually said man, beast, or demon. They're trying to find out what it is, and I thought that was kind of ironic. But, yeah, these types of reports sometimes appear in areas that are unexpected, and they really are well documented, and particularly with the Bigfoot phenomena and the UFO phenomena. This is a phenomena that's not new. There's nothing new about it. It's part of our heritage, part of our history, and it forms that long trail of sightings that form a common human experience.
Now, since you've been investigating so many different things, you've also looked at poltergeist stories, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. I was fortunate in the 1980s to have a firsthand poltergeist investigation go on right here in the town of Whitehall. Unfortunately, the home that occurred in has since burnt to the ground, which happens with a lot of these cases.
Jeez.
But in a synopsis, what had happened is this gentleman, who was very respectable, he was a friend of mine, and he had all of a sudden just started having things fly around his apartment, and dishes would break, and he lived in the upper apartment of this building. And dishes would break, and I had tons of pictures of the objects that were flown around. An ashtray would fly around, a table would move. And so this phenomena occurred to this gentleman to the point that it built. And it seemed almost like an energy had built up and then would just explode. And it culminated when he was sleeping one day in his bedroom, and he said that something appeared in the doorway, a dark figure. He said it was almost to the ceiling, so we're talking about eight to 9 feet, and it appeared and just scared him. And he said that it had tugged at his leg as if to jar his attention. And so this became a little more than the normal poltergeist case. This became, you know, we had a full apparition appear, and it was blocking him from leaving the room. So this created even more terror with the gentleman. And then finally it dissipated and he left. But we were able to document this outbreak as it would build. And it would go on we documented it for over a year. And it would build, and then you'll get all these events happen, and then nothing would happen for a couple of months. And then it would build again. And it seems to be, you know, some of these poltergeist cases can occur in brand new homes that have no haunted history connected to them. And, you know, obviously it's a word that means noisy spirit, German word. And so this is nothing new. I mean, we can go back to the Greeks and Romans talking about the knockings and the footsteps that are heard in these types of homes and hauntings. So we have this phenomena that, again, is a common human experience and is really kind of begging us to explain just what's going on.
Now, do you think skeptics, of course, have any grounds to do what they do?
Well, you know, my brother and myself are a good example of how a skeptic and objective researcher can get along just fine. We've never had any trouble with our research. And Bob would be considered he calls himself a sympathetic skeptic. He's very open to all this phenomena and very well-read in the investigations as well. So he looks at it from a more of a sociological point of view. I look at this as being physical and you know, metaphysical, if you want to use that term, phenomena, but something that can be documented, and it forms patterns. So we work together fine, and yet he would be considered a skeptic, and I would be termed a believer, if you want to use that phrase. But, yeah, I think skeptics are fine. I think we can objectively view things, and we can draw questions. It just becomes, you've got to be careful that on either side, it doesn't become a religion.
Right.
That you have to remain objective. You can't be skeptical to the point that you can't even consider something happening as being possible. And you can't be a believer so much that everything you hear is the absolute truth and there's no room for doubt. So there's got to be a midway there, and I think skeptics and believers can work together, although I see an awful lot of debunking that that is unfortunate, and I see a lot of in the other direction as well. People that have made this a religion and a cause, and you just have to remain objective.
Paul, in your investigations, has anybody ever been hurt by one of these creatures?
As far as our firsthand investigations, we haven't had any reports like that. I know in the literature there's a couple that, you know, you can go back to a classic case like Ape Canyon where boulders were thrown down on the cabin and so forth. But I think in the general nature of the reports, these are often not positive reports, positive experiences, but are benign in nature. For instance, when Cliff Sparks, who was the golf keeper here at Skene Valley Country Club, when he had his encounter in 1975, a full year before the Hebert Road incident, he said that he thought the creature was as scared of him as he was of it. But, you know, he didn't talk about it for quite a while, and then he finally came forward later on, and the only reason we got that report is he was friends with the family. So I don't think there's necessarily an evil nature, but there are some characteristics that are really interesting that are things you wouldn't expect. For instance, with Cliff's encounter, now this is a person who was a farmer. He was good friends with my dad, who was a farmer, and we had daughters that went to the same school together. And so we knew Cliff pretty well, and he knew what eye shine was, you know, when you get a reflection off of a creature's eyes and it looks kind of weird. He said that this creature that he saw had red glowing eyes, and he said that the eyes were what attracted him and really scared him, that the eyes, he had a dog, I'll give you a brief synopsis. It's 11 o'clock at night, and he's out with his dog on a golf cart taking care of the greens. And this creature is standing on green number one when he arrived.
Oh, boy.
At that time, they had the old electric carts that didn't make any noise. And so he startled the creature. The creature looks at him and then looks at the dog that is riding with Cliff in the cart. And he says that the dog became, which normally would get off and run around and stuff and then get back on the cart, just subdued himself over the edge of the cart as the eyes were hitting it. And the creature was focused
on the dog
itself.
It wanted Cliff, the dog.
Yeah. And Cliff got a great look at this creature as it was actually focused on the animal. And he said that the eyes were, and I'll give you the description. He said laser-like, almost like short dots coming out. And he knows the difference between reflected eyes and you know, eye shine and so forth. I know I was challenged a couple of times by some researchers about, oh, that's just eye shine. No, when you listen to Cliff's description, it's quite different. And it seems to pop up a lot in the different research that we did. For instance, we went back to some other reports of the eye descriptions, and whether it be demons or other creatures, they described a creature, a Bigfoot-type creature, back in the 1800s. And in the vernacular of the day, they said its eyes were like burning embers. So it was sort of another way to describe this same phenomena. So we have that report as well, which leads me to think that there's more to this than just biology.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the pterodont story was fascinating, too, because we continue to still get reports of these large birds, Paul.
Absolutely. And you know, isn't it interesting? Now, we only had the one report here in Whitehall, but he said it was like a liquid reality, and there was no question about it. It was this huge bird. And, you know, you would get people like John Keel would write with a sort of a funny wry to it, that he would say something like, well, where are the big nests and where are the big eggshells? You know,
they're so, way up there somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stay with us, Paul. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you as we talk about these strange anomalies, UFOs, Bigfoot, all these weird things that are out there in the Northeast section. I think they're all over the country, actually. We'll be back.